Thank you, Michelle. Michelle's one of our leading women's health regional coordinators for a long time within our office, and we're really thrilled with the wonderful work that she's doing around trauma and many other things that she can talk about if you give her a chance to. I'm Frances Ash Goins. I'm Deputy Director for the Office of Women's Health. And many times when I've been working in HIV/AIDS for as long as the epidemic, and I've been working in violence for about 20-something years. And it never ceases to amaze me. I'm a nurse, and I've been a nurse for about 40 years. But it never ceases to amaze me how people in healthcare get in their own little camp and then forget about what Michelle has so adequately explained to us about the intersection of traumatic events within a person's lives. So, I'm going to talk to you about the intersection of HIV and violence. But how did I get to this point? There was a women's HIV program in Washington, D.C., and they called me up to say, "Fran, I can't believe this has happened." And I said, "What's going on?" And they said, this young woman with her child was being battered, and she went to a shelter in Washington, D.C. And everything was going along fine until she disclosed that she had HIV, and she was put out. That was some years ago. Then I go to HIV/AIDS experts, educators, and I constantly see the wonderful preventive tool that we have for HIV, which is the male condom or the female condom. And then in your own mindset, you hear a woman tell me, she said, "Frances, they keep telling me to get my partner to put in a condom. How can I do that if I'm getting beat down every day? And if I mention that, I'm going to be assaulted even more because it appears that I'm the one that's not being faithful." I can't remember the name of the young woman, and I'm sorry, but maybe it's jet lag or something. But there was a woman that was just killed in Texas. I don't know if you heard this story. Real story. Killed when she disclosed that she was HIV positive. She's dead. Going to talk to you a little bit about this intersection. I also, federal government employee that I am, have no disclosures, no relationships with anybody, except my husband and my kids. Well, no financial. I think that's what they're talking about, commercial interest. I had to break it up because y'all were getting real serious on me. Because I presented you some real perplexing things. Okay, so intimate partner violence. You've heard that violence against women, DV, domestic violence, sexual assault. This is the newest term that CDC is using, intimate partner violence, which describes physical, sexual, psychological harm by a current, former partner, spouse. And this can occur in same-sex relationships and heterosexual relationships. And it does not require sexual intimacy. 30% of women experience IPV. 1.5 million women are sexually assaulted by their intimate partner, and it occurs across socioeconomic groups. It's not just the poor people, okay? These are some stats that talks about physical violence. It talks about, there in the green, you see that green section that talks about physical violence only. You see the 3% that's stalking only, and this is for female. You see the purple that talks about 12% for rape. You see the physical violence and stalking in the blue section that's 14%. And you see the rape and sexual violence for women at 9%. And then for the male partners, the male victims, you'll see that physical violence is 92%. These are just some of the data that I wanted to share with you. There is a count that's called domestic violence counts. And one day in a year, this organization, the National Network to End Domestic Violence, does a survey of all of the programs, identified programs within the United States. And 88% of those programs sent in their data. So this one day last year, on September 15, 2011, more than 67,000 victims were served in one day. However, more than 10,000 needs were not met. Their requests for services were not met due to the inability of the shelter to provide services for them. There were over 22,000 hotline calls. Y'all know the hotline number? Yeah, okay. Everybody didn't say yeah. Huh? Okay. 1-800-799-SAFE, just in case you didn't know it. More than 26,000 people were educated through trainings that's done by these centers. But look at the more startling thing. Unmet needs were for housing. There was no place for the people to go that needed services. Now, let's look at HIV. These are taken straight from CDC stats. If you look at the rates for women for the HIV infection, you'll see that the diagnosis for Black and African American women continues to outrank white people, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islanders, Asians, American Indians, Alaskan Natives, and the Latino Hispanic populations. If you look at the reasons for HIV infection, the risk factors are sexual, heterosexual contact in the pink for African Americans, for Latinas, and for white women. Injection drug use is only a small section of that. If you look at AIDS, that's across the years from diagnosis to 1985 to up to 2010, the African American rate I showed you before was even higher, but there seems to be a little dip, but not much compared to the other groups. Diagnosis and age at diagnosis, look at the amount of heterosexual contact for younger people. That's 13 to 19 at 53%. 20 to 24, 79.3%, and 25 to 34, 83.7%, and 35 to 44, 79%. So you can see, if you remember the data regarding when women have the most increase of violent episodes, it's the younger age, it's in the middle age. You also know that this is also the childbearing age, and you that are violence experts know that during childbearing, rates of violence also increase. So here we've got another confounding factor. Diagnosis of HIV affection among males and among females, men still carry the burden of this disease for HIV more so than women. The HIV infection transmission category, again, shows male-to-male sex contact. And I told you before, under our violence efforts, that it does occur in same-sex relationships, heterosexual contact, and then on down to injection drug use and male-to-male sexual contact and intravenous drug use. Diagnosis, again, by far is heterosexual contact. So why does this need to address the risk for HIV and when working with survivors of intimate partner violence? As you saw with the AIDS study, survivors may be at increased risk for contracting HIV/AIDS because many of them are repeatedly forced to endure physical and emotional trauma on a daily basis. I did a workshop with about 100 or so HIV-infected women. It was done by MAP Incorporated. And I just started talking about, it was an HIV workshop, so I was talking about HIV, and then I started to mention, knowing the AIDS study, I started to mention things about violence. And all of a sudden, it was a hush around the room. Of these 150 to 200 women, they changed the entire dynamic of the conversation, and they all started talking about
their violent episodes as a child. Many of them, most of them, had experienced childhood sexual trauma in one room. The injuries to the GYN area of the body for sexual activities may heighten exposure to the AIDS virus. You know that HIV is not easily transmitted. Take some action. Think about when a person's in a violent relationship, there are tears, there are breaks in the integrity of the mucosa in the, around the vaginal area and around the anal area. Perfect entryway for HIV. Survivors may be increased risk for contracting HIV due to depression and low self-esteem. I'll get some water real quick. I'm getting a little dry. Is that apple? Just think about what I said earlier about the women that talked about their childhood sexual trauma. And many times, even if they acknowledged it, nobody paid attention. Nobody paid attention. This is a fact. Throughout many of the survivors of childhood sexual trauma, talk about the times when they tried to inform a parent, a family member, a teacher, and because they were a child, somebody said, "You misunderstood," unless there was severe trauma. I'll never forget the little girl that came into the emergency room one time, and she came in with this huge infection. It was an STI. And the mother said, "Well, I don't know where she got that from." And then when you talk to the little three-year-old, she talked about how she played horsey with her uncle. And at first it hurt, but later on it was okay, and it became fun to play horsey with her uncle. He was the one that gave her the STI, and the mother never knew. Many survivors may also be reluctant to seek treatments for HIV because of feeling the guilt and the shame for being abused. The silence with the sex and the shame that comes with that over something that you think you may have had something to do with or participated in. And it many times, many victims do not talk about it. Lack of resources in the community to educate the public about the association between IPV and HIV may lead people to not have any way, any place for them to go. The lack of shelters, as I told you earlier, that were sensitive to the potential risk of contracting HIV during violent assaults maybe also contributes to the survivors being poorly diagnosed. Now, in this case, the people in the shelter were not educated about HIV. 30 years in the epidemic, it happens to somebody else. It doesn't happen to anybody that I know or anybody that I have to deal with. That views is still prevalent in the United States. Victims with HIV may be undiagnosed. They are reluctant to report their abuse. And typically, as I said before, the service providers in the shelters do not address their HIV status, therefore decreasing opportunities for access to HIV screening, treatment, and care. There are numerous efforts now to have more HIV testing as a regular course of preventive care. Policymakers and healthcare providers have recently recognized the critical association between HIV and the risk between IPV and the risk of HIV. The president, in about I think it was 2 months ago, recognized the importance of linking HIV and violence and gender health disparities and formed by presidential order a work group of federal people, I'm one of them, and from agencies to work on this issue. And we're working to inform the National HIV/AIDS Prevention Strategy to ensure that all the work around violence is also an integral part of the National HIV Prevention Strategy. We've had 3 meetings, and we're ever assured of going forth with our work. Now, in a 2003 study, they found that women who reported experiencing IPV were 2 times more likely to have multiple sex partners, and Michelle shared that with you earlier, 2.5 times likely to report having a past or current STI, 2.1 times likely never to use a condom, and 3.0 times more likely to report having a partner with a known risk factor for HIV. This gets into your sense of who you are and how important you are and your self-esteem, your low self-esteem. More than 1/3 of adolescent girls tested for STIs have experienced dating violence. And a 2000 study found that women disclosing physical abuse were 3 times more likely to experience an STI. Women disclosing psychological abuse were 2 times more likely to experience an STI. Psychological abuse is that hidden abuse, that one that only you know that it's occurring to you. There was a young woman who was a physician who I worked with who was experiencing domestic violence. And her husband, that was beating her up, was a lawyer. But he worked in the field, so he knew not to have any bruises on her that were readily seen. But one time he got really violent, and this time she had bruises on her neck. And when I immediately saw that, I asked her about it, and then she finally disclosed that she was a victim of domestic violence. But she also disclosed that her husband also given her an STI. It was treatable. It wasn't HIV. She got a shot, and she was okay. But can you imagine that? And that's why I'm saying it's not just the poor people. Here is a doctor and a lawyer making buku money, and they were still experiencing violence in their homes. What types of interventions are appropriate? Well, efforts must be made to encourage healthcare providers to be cognizant that when screening for HIV, you should also ask about violence in the home. Are you experienced? As your question is, what happened to you in your life? You know, you need to know this. Interventions, awareness that the severe power imbalance is what goes on in this situation, and that interventions need to be gender specific. Examples of gender sensitive interventions are providing patients with the opportunity to disclose. That's very, very important. I recently talked to Miss Hawaii, who shared with me at the conference that she was a victim of dating violence and stalking. And she was afraid to tell her parents because as far as they saw, he was a wonderful, wonderful person. But it was when she went to a healthcare provider that was not her regular family physician that this woman said, "Something is wrong with you. Tell me about it now." Because this child was diagnosed with eating disorders. She was diagnosed with depression. She was diagnosed with all of it, but nobody got to the root of the problem, and that was the dating violence that she was experiencing. Provide cross-training between STIs and DV programs. Design program evaluations to include sexual risk reduction and safety from violence, and develop a policy on partner notification for clients disclosing abuse. A policy? Develop a partner policy on partner notification for clients disclosing abuse. In your setting, in your situation, depending on your state, you develop policies that are best for the clients that you're dealing with because there are laws that are different from state to state regarding disclosure. But the biggest thing about the disclosure is to have access to resources for that client that may be disclosing. If I go back to the case in Texas when the woman was killed, I don't know that she had that opportunity to talk with somebody about it. What are the risks for disclosing and what does she need to do to protect herself? I don't think that would have occurred. But if there's a policy in the healthcare setting for the person that gave her HIV status, around domestic violence, then perhaps the outcome would have been different. And that's what I mean by that. This is an anecdote for one of the women that I picked up. And I got it from my husband. We were together 20 years. Can you believe it? It really bothered me at first, but I figure I'm not suffering alone. He's got to be suffering too. I don't know if he's dead or alive. I don't know where he is. I don't know nothing. Sometimes I wonder about him. I'd like to find out, but I'm going to let it be. That's my thanks for all these years. I don't need it. She was talking about her HIV. We in OWH have a program that addresses linking HIV and domestic violence. And we funded for the last 6 years several programs that link the two. These are our current grantees, and I would like to highlight one of them, and that's the Susan B. Spencer in Pennsylvania. What Susan did was actually go to the HIV testing sites in the health in the health centers and introduced to them all of the ramifications of disclosure and all of the ramifications of intimate partner violence in the lives of people. Now it's mandated that all of the HIV testing sites, all of the staff, have intimate partner violence training. The other thing that she's done, and she's not the only one, but I'll just highlight that one because that's an example of systems change. But all of the other ones have also gone into domestic violence shelters and provided HIV training for the staff workers there. And it's amazing. Many of the staff workers have written back in comments and evaluations of the program to say, thank you, because not only is this information valuable in my work with my clients in the shelters, but it also helps with my work outside in community when I'm talking about HIV. And it also helps myself and my families, because believe it or not, many people still say HIV happens to someone else. It doesn't happen to me. So we have the outcomes of these programs are increased HIV testing at shelter sites, increased cross-chaining for our DV shelter workers and HIV educators, increased health department programs that built on the intersection between HIV and violence, and increased safety for clients who experience both HIV and violence. This is my contact information, and I'm available for a Q&A later after our next speaker. Thank you very much.